This is the Hip Hop Saved My Life podcast. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Hope you enjoy the podcast. Now sit back, because it's time for the podcast.
Hello and welcome to Hip Hop Saved My Life. This is me, Ramesh Ranganathan. I've recorded the podcast already. I'm doing now the intro bit, sort of in my house, and it's about, what's the time, like 1 o'clock in the morning. Everyone else is asleep, so I've kind of, but I've got to do this intro bit, so I've come to the kitchen, dining room bit, and I've put a blanket over my head, because basically if I wake people up, shit's going to go down. So that's the current situation. You didn't need to know that, but you do. Today's episode, a few days ago I went to talk to a man called Jensen Karp. Jensen Karp, you may or may not have heard of, but he's a hip-hop fanatic. Current executive producer of a show called Drop the Mic, where celebrities rap battle each other, that you may or may not have seen. But also, and the main reason I wanted to talk to him is he was nearly like big time as a rapper. He's an author of a book called Kanye West Owes Me $300. And basically what happened was he nearly became a massive rapper. Like, he got $1 million deal from Interscope and then it all went tits up. So we talked to him about that on the podcast. It's a good episode. There's no rematch. There's no Ben Green. It's just me flying solo. So there's a dip in quality, but it's not all going to be gold. It's free. Do you know what I mean? This is Jensen Karp. Enjoy.
This is technically the closest I'll get to like a Tim Westwood interview ever. Like, I don't think, like, just your accent alone gets me the closest I'll be.
Yeah, I think I should sort of switch it up a bit. Like, yes, we're here with Jensen Karp.
It's so funny because, like, I used to watch those videos or listen to him on the radio and be like, there's no way he's super credible. And then I realized he's the most credible voice of all of hip hop.
Well, it's very, I was talking about this to somebody yesterday. It's very difficult for us because in the UK, you know, we are, as much of a hip-hop fan as I am by dint of me being British, an outsider looking in.
Right? Sure, well, I mean, I am as well, based on my face and my nose. Yeah.
But the thing was is that, like, when Westwood first came out, he was the best place to go and listen to hip-hop.
Yeah.
But the flip side of that is he talks how he talks, right? So you sort of got this situation where you're kind of, you sort of love him for bringing these artists onto the radio and playing all the best like tunes and that, and having like big American rappers on.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're thinking, why does he get to talk to these rappers like this, man? It's mad.
It makes it easier to understand why people thought Ali G was real. Because I was like, well, it's not much different between the two people.
I know. Did you know that he presented the UK equivalent of Pimp My Ride?
He was the exhibit. Yeah, yes. I knew that. And I also just like, he does good stuff. It's not that, it's crazy because like, it's not that his Ali G-ness comes out that much in his work. It's like, I remember recently, and I'm friends with him, so it's not like I'm like talking out of school, but Dickie went on.
Yes.
Little Dickie went on, and Dickie was great on it. Like, it was pretty much the best thing he's done. And I texted Dickie and was like, that was the best thing you've ever done. He was like, Tim Westwood's not a character. Like, he was just as shocked as I was that's really what the guy's like. I think the freestyles there are good. The fact that like he still has Jadakiss on or whatever he can do when he gets him in there.
Yeah.
I guess it's like growing up for me, that's how it was for the Wake Up Show and for Friday Night Flavors, which was a show here in Los Angeles, more regionally. And Wake Up Show started in Oakland, but then it became more of a national show. But those were the two places I got to go. And then before that, you know, there was sort of New York Hot 97 shows and stuff that I'd have sent to me, whether it's Stretch and Bobbito or whatever. I'd have those kind of sent to me by people I knew in New York.
Do you listen to any UK? I mean, are you aware of UK hip-hop?
I mean, I'm super aware of it, mostly, honestly, because of, like, the resurgence that Drake has sort of forced into everyone's minds. But, I mean, I bought all the Dizzy Rascal stuff back in the day. I mean, I basically the 101 stuff. And then now I haven't got too, like, as far as my knowledge that people make fun of and say I know everything about hip-hop, I wouldn't know as much about grime as I do of the States hip-hop. But I know enough to, like, pop culturally from the sides know what's happening.
Yeah, got you.
And it's incredible what has been going on.
It's mad for us because, like, when I was growing up, because you and I are about the same age, but when I was growing up, obviously really into US hip-hop, and then UK hip hop sort of started to emerge, and there's all these great artists coming out, but it just never got anywhere.
Yeah.
But then with grime, because it sounds so different, I guess, it's been very exciting over in the UK. But the thing that we've got is that people in the UK think that UK hip hop is grime, but there is another scene where really great hip hop is being made, and it's not grime. And some people think there shouldn't be a division, and some people think it's completely different. It's not the same, but it's a very good, it's a great scene over there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, I think that the scene itself has gotten so much of a boost because of dance music and because EDM fans and rap fans are becoming so interchangeable.
Yeah,
like as far as Coachella, the people who are happy Jay-Z's headlining are the same people that like any EDM DJ that are just passing my mind right now. Yeah. Like any of those guys. Basically Calvin Harris or Skrillex, like those are the same fans as Wu-Tang.
Totally.
So grime gets a good boost because of that, because the music is similar in that way. But then you look back and you sort of listen to the streets and these guys that have been doing, that were doing it back when there was no shine on it. And it's hard for me to see the difference other than the idea that now they're rapping over beats that maybe Drake would have.
That
seems like the biggest difference, really. Like, the streets was doing stuff that, like, you could have heard on Def Jux.
Yes.
Get my phone out, about to give this girl a shout. See if she had a nice time last night uptown. Ask if she fancies trying it again sometime. Then Cal grabs the phone like, oi, 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 oi. Hold it down, boy. Yeah.
He was doing, like, underground hip-hop, but it's really the same shit. It's just over a different beat.
Yeah, I totally agree.
It's not a ton different. But I think having a feature, which I think is something no British rapper could really have had.
No.
Until recently. Having like a real prime feature or something like that. Like that shit goes so far for hip hop.
Yeah.
Like it almost can revive a whole scene. Look at reggaeton.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Have you heard of, you won't have done, well, you might have done, Apache Indian? Are you aware of Apache Indian?
Well, you mean of the sample or is this a different name?
No, Apache Indian as in the Indian, British Indian dancehall star, right? So he did Boom Shakalak, which was on, I think it was on Dumb and Dumber, it might have been. But anyway, the reason I mention him is he's like this Indian-British guy who sort of does his music in like
Punjabi MC?
Yeah, sort of like, yeah. So, but he does his music in all like a dancehall patois.
Okay.
And he, I remember being blown away because somehow, I don't know what record label manifestation made this happen, but he ended up doing a song with Tim Dog, right? It was insane.
How that happened?
I know. Mini mini Miami, a fire with me. Hey, smoke signal, them a flying at the sky. Hey, Indian fi know an ex-co wife fi die. Hey, my time fi shaka, why are your time fi cry? Yo, give me the boom back, 'cause I move every rap. I come back with a fat track, I like it like that. Pick up the raw sound with more ground. Much respect to the reggae sound in Birmingham. Let's,
you know how that shit happens? I'll actually tell you how I think that happens.
Go on.
I think Tim Dog goes on tour.
Right.
And I think he meets him backstage because someone's like, yo, this dude's hot, blah, 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 blah. He's like, yo, we should do a track together. And then it just actually happened. Because that's what, in the 90s, if you did a song with someone international, I think it always meant you just did a tour there.
Yeah,
that
I guess
so. That was what I always got.
Yeah, they just like,
especially Tim Dog.
They had a smoke together or something. Yeah. And he said, oh, I really like Fuck Compton.
Or he paid him.
Yes, I mean, that's probably,
didn't even think
they probably
that.
Didn't even meet.
Yeah.
So anyway, the reason I wanted to talk to you, the main reason I want to talk to you, is you've got an incredible story. And for those of you that haven't checked it out, Jensen's got a book out called Kanye West Owes Me $300, which is well worth the look.
Thanks.
But basically, you were almost a huge rapper, right?
Yeah. I mean, I had all the steps until the last one accomplished. Basically, everything until becoming famous had a checkbox next to it. The only thing missing is becoming famous.
This is my understanding of the start of the story,
yeah.
But I'm sure I know that it goes beyond this.
Yeah.
But the thing that sort of elevated you was that you phoned up Power 106, which is a big hip hop station over here.
Yeah.
Do you listen to Power 106 now?
No, I mean, I don't think it's weird. It was during a time when the radio was all we had.
Right.
Like it, so we didn't have iPods, we didn't have Sirius radio, we didn't have really CD players in your car was kind of just becoming a norm.
Right.
So if you wanted radio hip hop, that's all you had.
Right.
Was basically so Power 106 was prime, but now I listen to mostly Shade 45 or my phone.
Cuz I came over here very excited about listening to hip hop in context.
That's a bummer.
And so I put on Power 106.
It's a dance station, yeah.
Yeah, it's mad. And they have five songs that they sort of just...
Absolutely. K-Day is great, though.
Right,
we do have a great station here, but it's mostly old school.
Right, great. Well, that's not... That's a good thing.
Yeah.
So you phone up. So they're doing a battle thing, a battle show. Listeners phone in.
Yeah, they've been doing it for like a decade.
And so you phone in and you win, right?
Yeah, these guys called the Baker Boys, who were kind of like staples in hip-hop. They produced Pistol Grip Pump, actually.
Right. Okay.
And so they were radio DJs here, and they were doing this thing for like a decade. They created it, and it ended up going to Hot 97 with Ed and Dre.
Yeah.
But it started here, and it was just like a phone call program where you would call in, and a guy would... they would have a champion from the night before, and that person would battle 3 to 4 people a day over the phone, and then listeners would call in and say who won. And, you know, the average age of those contestants are probably 15, 16.
Right.
And I had done it when I was 15, 16. I had done it even when I was younger. And when I was 19 years old, I was driving home to college and from a job, and I heard them say, we're doing it now, and I thought it was funny. Like, I should do it. And I called and did, you know, I was an animal. Like, at that point, I had been battling... for, you know, my whole life. And at that time, I was kind of going out again. I was going to ciphers and going to competitions and doing as much as I could. And so here comes this sort of adult man coming in to almost like Billy Madison swat the balls away. And so, yeah. And so I ended up on the program for like over 40 days. And the champion before me, the highest ever, had been like 10.
So when you phoned up, were you thinking... No, this is just going to be a laugh.
Yeah,
Or were you thinking, did you actually have aspirations?
No, it was a laugh.
Right.
I mean, I thought winning would be a cool aspiration.
Right.
But like nothing beyond that station, no.
But when you won the first day.
Yeah.
Sorry, when you phoned in the first day, were you thinking, I've listened to the sort of standard they've got on there. This is in the bag pretty much.
Not in the bag. Because I thought maybe my nerves. Also, like rapping over the phone is a thing. It's very hard. Because you have to hear their beat.
Right.
So like when you're rapping, you don't hear the beat anymore.
Because
yelling.
As soon as you start.
Yeah, as soon as you start, you stop hearing the beat. So there's a bit of a talent in just knowing where the beat falls. And I've always been good at that, especially probably because of that phone thing. But like I can pretty much rap the metronome without having it there.
Right.
So I was just sort of like, just don't mess up. And that's how Hawk Carl, the name that I selected, was
selected.
So
how did this name...
I don't know. They go, what's your name? And I had not thought about it when I called in. And so... I had messed around with names. I'd always been just like Jensen or just took on other names. And I'd never had like a set name in rap, really.
Right.
And I just thought, I had a second to think. And Hot Carl was a term for shitting on someone's chest, like in a sexual act. And I always thought that was funny because like battling, that's what you're trying to do is just shit on somebody.
Right.
And so that's what came out of my mouth. And had I known where it was going to go, I wouldn't have said that. I would have come up with something a lot smarter. But it was all just so fast that I never would have thought, I maybe a win or two.
So you won for, is it 40 days?
40 something days, yeah.
Right. So you win, and then that is sort of what that's what sort of got you a deal, right? Essentially, is that
right? That's it. Yeah. I mean, I did I recorded songs also so that Jimmy, because like at the time, a couple labels wanted me.
Right.
And the one that I wanted was Interscope and Jimmy Iovine. And so
Why was that you wanted to go Interscope?
I just knew they had No Doubt, and they had U2, and they had, like I had met Gerardo, which is like such a weird name.
Yeah.
But like Gerardo was an A&R there, the guy who created Rico Suave, and he was so nice. And I had a friend, Bubba Sparks, who obviously went on to release music, and Bubba was like looking at Interscope, and it was the place to be. It was the Yankees.
Right.
So I was approached by a bunch of other people, but I wanted to sort of...
You were holding out.
Yeah.
So you finish your 40 days.
Yeah.
And then what exactly happened?
Well,
next?
I finished college basically at the same time. So
right.
I really focused on college right when I got off the radio. And then during that time, I would, not finish college, but my junior year. And then during that summer, I recorded a couple songs, a couple with DJ Lethal from House of Pain and then Limp Bizkit. And then a couple with DJ Homicide, who would come up with The Alcoholics and then ended up in Sugar Ray, which is a weird trajectory. And then basically some other producers that just people put me with, DJ Cheap Shot, who worked with Styles of Beyond, and a bunch of other beat dudes. And I recorded a song, and one of them was a hit. One of them I recorded pretty quickly and was like, that's a hit, called Caliente Carlito, which was like a jokey song pretending I was Latin. And I knew that was it, and the labels were already interested in me, so I just started doing those meetings. And pretty quickly, two people jumped out in front, one being The Firm, which was this guy, Jeff Quantenance. who went on to manage like Britney Spears, but has always managed Ice Cube. So I like that was enough for me.
Yeah.
That's Ice Cube's manager. And then Jimmy Iovine was the other one. Capitol Record showed some interest. Some other people did, but no one as much as, you know, sending a money offer. And Jimmy's offer was so high that I really couldn't go anywhere else.
So was it like when Interscope contacted you? So obviously you've got a massive hard on at this stage.
Huge.
Like the dreams are coming.
It's a joke. Yeah. This was a bit.
Is it exactly how people think it is, where you get taken this big office and they're going, you're going to be massive and blah, blah, blah?
Yeah, mostly. It's pretty much the bit. It's what you think it is.
Right.
And then, but on top of that, there's like, you kind of think you'd be in control of it because you like know, like, you know what's going to happen here. You've seen enough behind the musics. You know what I mean? Like, you've seen what goes on. And then when you're in the situation, things go so fast in a way, you're like, you're talking to, I didn't have a lawyer. And I was in Jimmy Iovine's house and he says, $1 million. Like, I didn't have a lawyer. So I just, he was like, I'll call your lawyer tomorrow. And I was like, I didn't say anything to him, but in my mind, I'm like, I got to find a lawyer. So like things don't, like it's not, like whenever anyone talks about like predetermined Illuminati shit, I'm always just like so envious. Like what if I, like, you really knew what was going to happen? Like I knew nothing of what was going to happen. So like on a Thursday when I signed a $1 million deal, you don't go to work on Friday. Like you wait to figure out when you're going to start recording your album. Like all that stuff to me was foreign. I didn't know what any of that meant. So, like, I'm waiting for them to be like, here's a beat CD. You're going to New York. Like, all that. Okay, whatever you want. Like, I think at 19 years old, it's almost impossible.
But what I would say is, even at that young age when all this is happening to you, you're very much yourself the whole way through that. You know,
yes.
Sort of like your look, the things you talked about,
yeah, I was
all
the
of
first,
those things.
I was really I always stand by the idea that I was the first white, actual white rapper.
Yeah.
And nowadays, it would be hard to find someone who doesn't look like they work at PacSun.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's G-Eazy and Dickie and Mac Miller and God. And then there's a whole subgenre of Hoodie Allens and all these other names of guys that sound like me and look like me, don't know who I am, so it's not like they're copying me. But I've always sort of thought that I was ahead of my time in going out there and being like, I grew up in the suburbs. I'm not going to put on a fake voice. I'm not going to be any different. I know I'm a murderer. I know I could kill. I've been told it since I was little. And now I have to have that choice. But I don't think that the world was ready at that time to hear like a normal kid rapping.
Was that a conscious decision or did it like...
Yeah, because I love the art form. Honestly, I love the art form too much. And I was raised in, you know, I was managed by Rhyme Syndicate at like 12 years old, and they encouraged me to be a white guy, you know, for lack of a better word.
So how the hell did you get involved with Rhyme Syndicate? I mean, how did that
So happen? I was at a party growing up when I was like a kid, and I was always rapping. Like, yeah. It was always a thing. Like, even when kids in my school didn't even really know what it was. And so I was mimicking the words to Choice Is Yours. I was just mimicking them when they were on being played at this party.
Who's the black sheep? What's the black sheep? No, not who I am or when I'm coming, so you sleep.
And a guy came up to me, he was like, if I hand you a microphone, will you rap into it? And I was like, yeah, sure. And so I did it. And that guy ended up being super connected to hip hop out here in LA. And so he was like, do you rap professionally? And I was like, no. I was like, I'm kind of in a group with this kid in my middle school, the only black kid.
So he's asking, you're 12 at this point.
Yeah, 12.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And I looked like a Boy Scout. Like, I even looked less hip hop then than I did later. And so he goes, yeah, I want you to open for Rhyme Syndicate and Ice-T. With your group. And I was like, well, we don't have any songs. And so this man, this 20-year-old kind of DJ, started to help us put together songs and dance routines and stuff. And so then we ended up opening for Ice-T here in LA.
God.
Yeah, that was like some fantasy camp shit. Because it was like, I was such a fan, even of Donald D, who ended up managing me.
Yeah.
So like Henji and Evilly and all these names that I knew from Everlast, all these names that I knew from Syndicate stuff, they ended up being at, basically a lot of them ended up being at that show, and then Donald started managing us, and we did, you know, we worked with them for about a year and then didn't come together. The riots happened, and I think
right.
I think it was a sort of a weird situation for Ice-T to have white guys on his label, because Everlast also kind of stopped working with them.
I mean, that is insane.
Yeah. It was a crazy
12 years old, man.
Yeah. I posted the video on YouTube recently of us opening for Ice-T. And I think if you just put in like 12-year-old Jensen Karp, don't just put 12-year-old, you weirdo. But if you put in 12-year-old Jensen Karp, I think it comes up.
That
and you
insane.
See me, yeah, you see me at 12. Kumail Nanjiani recently walked up to me and was like, hey, I was like, what? He's like, I have to admit to you how many times I've watched you rapping at 12 years old. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, yeah, here's why. And he explained it almost perfectly. He's like, and also for me, this is also how I feel about it. He says, I couldn't have felt less connected to you, because we've been friends for years. He's like, I couldn't have felt less connected to watching you at 12 years old be so confident.
Right.
He's like, I don't know anyone or have ever seen anyone be that confident at 12 years old about anything they're doing. He's like, and I was so nervous in my room, like thinking I knew comedy or thinking I knew music or blah, blah, blah. I would never have even opened my mouth to talk. He's like, and here you are sort of guiding this art form, you know, at such a young age. And I look at it similarly. Like, I don't look at it now and think that's me. I'm like, holy shit, that 12-year-old is going to rule the world. Like, I don't think, I lost confidence over the years from that point.
Yeah.
So, like, seeing it is shocking. And also, I'm shitting on Another Bad Creation. The whole song was a diss song talking about how small their dicks are. I wrote the whole thing at 12 years old. It's a very, I was in a very weird wormhole of hip-hop at the time.
Because most...
Tim Dog was a huge influence at the time.
Oh, right, right.
Huge, 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 yeah.
So, because most kids that are that confident in that age will end up becoming serial killers or
something
like that.
Yeah, 100,
right?
You watch it and you're going to think, like, that guy's going to murder his girlfriend and then hide her in a dumpster.
Right.
There is a weird, I also don't know, like Bieber and stuff, like kids who blew up at that age. Like, I don't even know if, I think this is more startling.
It's crazy.
Yeah, it's weird.
So you get the deal from Interscope, and then sort of what happened from there?
I record the album. So basically, you know, they put $800,000 into recording this album between here in New York City, LA and New York, and I end up recording with Redman and Fabolous and Maya.
I mean, the list of names of people.
Yeah, DJ Quick, Kanye, Black Eyed Peas. At the time, Sugar Ray, because that was a good thing to do. MC Search. You know, it was just sort of like whoever I wanted, I could record with.
And how does that work? Does that, like, you pay the money and they'll come up with anyone, basically?
Yeah, yeah. Back in the day, it wasn't... Well, not anyone.
Right.
But yeah, money helps.
They don't want to be on a corny record, though.
Yeah, right? Yeah. They would stop that. And there were people who just... Beanie Siegel was originally supposed to be the other guy on the song with Fabolous. And I had called... Beanie had got the offer... And then Beanie called me, which was super sweet, and was just like, listen, I don't think you're whack at all. He's like, I actually think you spit on this record. He's like, I just am not a pop culturally funny guy.
Right.
He's like, so I don't really even do references. He's like, so I could do it. He's like, but I think your best bet would be going for someone who can, like, do the same thing as you. And so it ended up being Fab and Redman, which makes sense because they're kind of punchline dudes. But, like, you know, he didn't want to jump on, even just to get the 15 or 20K at the time.
I think
he was still like, this isn't best for me, but I'll do it if you need me.
To get a call. What are you like on the phone to these people, in the room with these people?
Crazy. I mean, I end up doing phone calls with, like, most everyone. Like, did a phone call with RZA, who was, like, one of my idols.
Yeah.
Like, a phone call with Timbaland, a phone call with, you know, I kind of just sat there. I don't know.
And
just,
are you being like you're being now?
Yeah. Almost the exact same. There's a weird story in the book about RZA and I talking on the phone where he just kept comparing me to characters on Happy Days. So he'd be like, so you're like the Fonz of hip-hop? And I'm like, no, that would be too cool. He's like, so you're like the Potsy. I was like, no, that's not cool enough. Like, and then after a while, I'm like, why are we still doing these Happy Days references?
Wow.
But, like, weird shit would happen, yeah. Like, stuff like that. I mean, and the fact that I was involved with Kanye so early, it's like, I was really like a real zealot about it. Like, I was always put in these places, and I would see it and be part of something that I had idolized my entire life.
And you sort of say that you believe that you're one of the people that kind of underestimated what Kanye was doing, or
for sure. I mean, there were a lot of people, but yeah. I mean, I'd never underestimated his production.
Right.
I literally thought he was going to be the next biggest producer in the world.
Yeah.
I thought that from the minute I heard his beat CD.
Right.
But as far as rapping, I always thought he was garbage.
What was he like to be around?
Well, I always reference Bowfinger, which is like common reference, because he had adult braces when we met, and he was dressed in like this big, like a Nietzsche jumpsuit, and he was just too eager. He was just so eager. And a lot of people don't say that when they're talking about Kanye, which is weird, because if you were around those days, which a lot of us were, eager has to be the first word out of your mouth, because he was always so wanting. He wanted to do everything. He wanted to be on everything, and he wanted to tell you he was a rapper, which was something his managers didn't really want him saying,
right?
Because the rapper producer wasn't really a thing. So focus on producing. You're good at it. And so he was just like earnest and jumpy and faulted, but like as far as like egomaniac, I don't think I would have ever said that. I probably would have just said over eager. Like, he would rap at waitresses and stuff.
But he didn't talk about, like, how he was going to be. Because now, it sort of feels like he believes that his life is a work of art.
No, he was more of like, I'm going to take the game over, but like the same way any rapper with a demo would tell you that.
Right.
It wasn't any different. It wasn't like, he told me he was an artist, which doesn't come up much. Two things that were crazy about Kanye then that don't come up much now. One is he was super into movies, which like doesn't come up ever now, right?
Yeah.
He never talks about movies. No. But that's all he did. He owned like tons of Blu-rays. That's how we got along so well, because we both collected like DVDs at the time. And we both collected them, so we talk about them a lot. And then we saw a movie together. He loved movies. That was a big... And I think he always wanted to make movies. That I remember coming up a lot. That's never come up again. And then the other thing is he...
I mean, it can't be outside of the realms of possibility that he's working on a film. I mean,
I think he gave up on it.
Really?
I really do, yeah. I think he tried the Larry Charles show.
Right.
He tried certain things, tried Anchorman. I think he's really bad at acting.
Right.
So I wonder if maybe, but even writing or directing, yeah, it's never come up.
Because he strikes me as a guy that will not shy away from diversifying into anything. Do you know
yeah,
what I mean?
I think he, I, from if, what I know, he definitely just stopped.
Right.
And that was something he loved. And then the other thing is he was an art student. You know, he was a drawer and a painter and stuff, and that never comes up. But when I had opened an art gallery, we had talked about him putting stuff in the gallery at the time, and I think we were going to do it, and then I think time just didn't work out. But he was always like a sketcher, you know, he always sketched and stuff. But that, again, no one talks about it. But those were the two things we talked about a lot. Art and movies. Movies mostly. He would text me two-way page me, like, what movie should I rent at Blockbuster? All the time. That was like his big thing. And now we don't even hear him talk about movies, so.
That's mad.
Yeah.
So you record the album.
Yes.
And then what happens?
Well, I have a song with Search.
Yeah. Are you happy with the...
No.
In terms of recording the album, what were you happy with it?
At that time?
Yeah.
Yes, I was happy with songs. And then I thought we could build it into an album. But I think like piecemealing an album, I realized quickly is a bad idea then.
Right.
Like even though it was happening everywhere, like everyone was getting a beat from Timbaland, a beat from so-and-so, a beat from so-and-so.
That was very much the thing, wasn't
it?
That was it. Features
there was,
and...
There was no other thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, even over features, production hits were bigger than features then.
Right.
But like now I like it was just like all over the place. I would go in with Damon Elliott or somebody and a song would sound completely different than when I went in with Quick or whoever. And I think that affected my hearing of the album. Even if like it wouldn't have in the marketplace, I don't think people would have been bothered by that, but it bothered me. And that was enough for me to be annoyed. And then around the time that I was supposed to start meeting about college radio, the sort of like, buzz is the wrong word. The resources for me to work with on my album like just fell apart.
Right.
It was just like no one was there anymore. And I was like, what the hell's going on? You just spent $800,000 on an album.
So just what, everyone disappeared? You
pretty much, yeah. I was warned. Someone called me
and
was like, there's something weird going on with your project. You should look for another label. And I was like, look for another label? They pay me $5,000 a month. I got a, you know, $300,000 advance. Like, where would I go? This is...
Yeah.
They just paid me. I'm rich, technically.
Yeah.
I'm 19 years old. I'm rich. And I got a publishing deal at the same time from Warner Chappell, which gave me $250,000 in one check, just handed it to me in a check.
My God.
And I was like, I can't go anywhere. What are you talking about? You know, and I know this sounds like the world's smallest violin because there's so much money there, but when you're like 19, it's not, it's a huge deal.
Yeah.
Cause like the word recoupable comes up in both of those advances. They're not really played out to be recoupable. Like that doesn't really happen. It's never technically happened in anything. But like they could ask for the money back. Like there's a lot of issues that go on in this. And so it immediately just shakes my world. And I do end up leaving the label after it falling sort of exactly what the phone call warned me.
But when you got the phone call,
yeah,
was there part of you that was thinking, I can still power through this?
Yeah, or that guy's lying.
Yeah,
all those things. Yeah, well, I don't know if I could power through, but I just thought it may be wrong.
Right.
More wrong than anything else.
But he was right. And it
he was right, yeah. And basically what he said on that phone call was that there's issues with releasing me and at the time Bubba Sparks, who was sort of getting ready for round two.
Right.
There was problems within the label because Eminem was making so much money for them. So it would be like if Howard Stern was on in mornings and then they put Imus after him. It wasn't that they thought they'd take away from Imus's or Howard's audience, but it's just not worth it to do it when you're up against a cash cow.
I see.
So and I recently met with Jimmy Iovine last week, which
is
crazy.
I saw you tweeted about this, and you gave him a copy of your book.
I did.
Jimmy, so how did that meeting go down?
Jimmy reached out to me. My name came up in another meeting.
Right.
He said, like, he was like, I know that guy. I signed him when he was 19. Like, yeah, that was him, Hot Carl. He goes, I'm going to bring him in. And then we just had an hour-long uncle-to-nephew chat.
And what did he say to you? This is incredible.
It was mostly just business. Like, it was mostly just like talking up and catching up. We talked about our families, talked about life, talked about being 39 because I turned 39 next year. He talked about that was the year he started Interscope. A lot of like encouragement. He wants me, like he knows that I'm doing really well as far as writing for other people's things. He's like, but I think it's time for you to have like a scripted of your own. A lot of like, real weird. We hadn't talked in a decade, and he, you know, he helped me go through college with it. You know, he was the biggest. He's changed my life more than anyone ever.
Yeah.
And so this was the first time we really saw each other, and it was really nice. It was very weird. He got the book. He kind of figured out it's about him. He knew it existed. He didn't know exactly what it was. And
did
very
he
odd.
Say anything about like sort of being upset with regretful with the way that it went down?
No, I think the only real chat we had about that, most of it was about me now.
Right.
But the only stuff we talked about in the past is he just sort of alluded and acknowledged that Eminem ate it up.
Right.
And I think that's, and I told him at 38 years old, right, it's easier to hear that. And at 20 years old, you don't understand the business aspect of it, and he didn't really say anything back. But it was sort of an acknowledgement that like the world's biggest white rapper was on the label, and then there were other white rappers who probably should have got a chance, would have got a chance at another label, but just bad timing.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Do you think like now, because like at that time, like when Eminem blew up or whatever, being a white rapper was different to being a white rapper now, right?
Yeah.
Like it's
right, it's weirder when a black rapper hits.
Yeah, exactly. So do you think it was just that at that time? Because if Eminem existed, like, you know, if we had, I know
wouldn't
Eminem does exist now, but now in that same scenario, it wouldn't be an issue at all.
No,
right?
you think Machine Gun Kelly affected G-Eazy?
Yeah.
No one even puts them together.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but back in my day, yeah, I would have been compared to everyone. And I was compared to Bubba. We looked nothing alike. We sounded nothing alike.
Yeah.
Like we still were in the same category.
Because white rap then was a genre.
It was its own genre. And now it's rap.
Yeah.
Now I think, honestly, I think Earl Sweatshirt is an anomaly.
Yeah.
Right? I think Vince Staples is an anomaly. I think those dudes get almost, like they get the signifier almost at this point.
Yeah.
Like the signifying isn't white rapper anymore. No. And that's all it was for me.
Yeah.
I was just way ahead of my time in that way.
And did you, so you, after the Interscope thing happened, did you... What can you do with that album then? Can you take what you've got and try and move it elsewhere? Or is
So I had a real fear as to what would happen for good reason, right? Like my lawyers are making me feel okay about it, but I just was like, I don't know what to do. Like, and so EMI had just given me all that money for a publishing deal, and I was nervous that at any point they could ask for it back. Like I didn't know what to do. And so I ended up getting this kind of like this, I don't know, heaven sent email from this guy at BBE, which was actually a UK record label.
Yes, yeah.
Barely Breaking Even, which was through, I think, another bigger name. But they put out like the J Dilla instrumentals. They put out a bunch of Roy Ayer stuff.
Right.
And it obviously doesn't fit well with Hot Carl, but a guy named Eddie Bezalel had heard the Hot Carl stuff and was smart enough to call me and be like, one day every rapper is going to look and sound like you. He's like, I think you're like 10 years too early. He's like, but eventually all of them will be you. He's like, and I just want to try to be the first to do it. So why don't we put something out on the smaller
label?
That's
an incredible thing to hear, right?
Yeah, that's what he said. And at the point, I was like, fuck you. I'm just trying to survive. I really was. I was just trying to make it. And I knew that if he gave me $6,000 or $10,000 as that advance, I'd be able to use that. And then two, if I put out the record through him, I could always say I tried my hardest to the publishing deal. You can't sue someone for trying their hardest. And so I just put the record out.
Right.
So I recorded like 5 or 6 new songs with him. And then BBE bought like 2 from Interscope.
Right.
One being the Search song, which I said I always wanted.
Yeah.
And then I don't remember the other one he bought. But that's where I did that song with Ninth Wonder, which was like the retirement song.
Yeah.
But I knew I was out at that point.
I mean, how did that feel?
Which one? To be out?
Yeah.
Good. I mean, I never, you know, everyone thinks you're a rapper. forever. Like, yes. When you sign a record deal, you're a rapper.
Right.
And a second life for a rapper still in 2017 is almost impossible.
Right.
Right? When someone fails in hip-hop, they're cannabis.
Yeah.
You don't get a second. Like, Romany Malco, right, was in that group Brotherhood Creed, I think.
Yeah.
Or was he in College Boys? He's in one of those two groups. He's went on to become an amazing comedic actor. He doesn't talk about his hip-hop career. Like, nobody fails in hip-hop and then makes it. It's rare. Scott Kahn is always a good story, which was like he was in Hooligans and now he's Scott Kahn.
Yeah.
Like, it rarely happens. So to me, that equals living under a freeway. Like, you fail in hip-hop, you're always going to be a laughing stock. At that time, now, fuck it. No one cares. But at that time, it's like a stigma on you. It's the scarlet letter of hip-hop. And so I don't know. So at that point, I have no idea. I gained so much weight. I was in over 200 pounds. I'd started antidepressants to sort of defeat this feeling. And then, I sort of had a breakdown a bit through it and came out of it and opened an art gallery and just sort of tried to get out and tried to find creative outlets outside of this one that I was supposed to be pigeonholed in and sort of hit a dead end and found a U-turn. And that was where the art gallery came in and comedy writing and just sort of getting out there and performing non-hip hop stuff, doing stand up again. And just sort of trusting that there's another goal for me.
Did you, when that all that happened, cause like I know, for example, like as a comedian in the UK, if I do a show that I think I was shit on, and this is not the same, but like I can never watch that show again. Like even
I can't even watch what I'm good at. But yeah.
Yeah. So like for hip, were you able to enjoy hip hop?
No.
Right.
No.
So you just stopped listening to it completely?
No, I did. I would listen to it almost like secretly. You said enjoy hip hop.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I still listen to it. No, I couldn't enjoy it. Everyone was garbage, or you know, I had to be on my lookout for every Eminem song and think how bad it is. And it's like, I didn't enjoy it until years later again. And now I love it again. And that took a long time, but yeah, it was a burn victim. So it was like getting closer to the fire each time. And now I'm back and stupidly fully engulfed in between Drop the Mic and knowing every mixtape that drops. And I downloaded the Jaden Smith record for no reason.
Like, so you're still into it as a, everything. I mean, you're probably more across it than anybody. Yeah. Aren't I? Like you know
I'm
everything.
More across it now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Than I was even.
Oh really? Ago. Right. Yeah. And what are you listening to at the moment? Like, is there stuff that you really like?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's weird. I think we're in a time where it's very easy to say how bad it is, right? Because there's this generational argument that if we didn't have Trump, right, the biggest thing in hip-hop right now would be this generational gap, which no one really talks about now because we have bigger fish to fry. But there are a lot of people talking shit between both of them, which is like mumble rap. The Post Malone quote is kind of about that. And you have on the other side, someone came out recently, but a lot of guys sort of saying, someone had a great quote that said, we made hip-hop to sell drugs to. These kids make hip hop to take drugs to, which was a good quote this week. But the way I look at it is like, we have to let go of Slaughterhouse, right? We have to let go of these lyrical rappers and say, if we're going to support them at this age, we need to support them directly. We need to not think of them as hip hop anymore, because hip hop is a genre that moves with the streets, right? It's never wanted to stay stagnant. And this movement no longer includes those guys.
Yeah.
Right? There's no longer a lyricist really that we can be excited about other than Kendrick.
Yeah.
Or because I'm not going to put Drake in that. I'm a huge Drake fan. I'm a huge Drake fan, but I'm not going to put Drake
in that.
It's not the same. But I've been successful now in my mind over the last 2 years separating them.
Right.
Understanding that I can like the Uzi Vert record, which I do. But 2 years ago I would have said, well, that's just not for me. I'm almost 40.
Yeah.
But now I listen to it and I pull out a couple songs out of the Uzi Vert record or, the Future record or 21 Savage or whoever. I can pull out songs. I'm not gonna listen to the whole record, but now I've developed, I don't hear it being bullshit in my ear anymore. I am starting, if you want to get really technical, I am starting to feel 40 years old with the Little Xanny world.
Right.
So like that world and, like Little Peep, I understood because it sounded like emo stuff.
Right.
But like as far as like just chanting-ish rap, then I'm starting to go, oh fuck, I'm not there
yet. You can't access that.
No, not yet.
Yeah.
But I have gotten to a point where I hate saying mumble because it's such an easy dumb thing to say, but like, I just think people have to categorize more now. Hip hop's so big that we have to start seeing grunge rock, and we have to start seeing different categories. And older dudes like me and you, we have to let go of the idea that, you know, like, I think Jada and Fabulous are working together now. Isn't that a thing?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Like they're going to have a record together or whatever. Like, get excited about that then. Like, put your energy towards that. But let's not pretend that has to be on the radio, because it can't. It's not what hip hop is.
So, you sort of highlighted on the main issue for people of our age, like with regards to hip-hop, and also probably most of the people that listen to this podcast. But do you think, like, you know, for example, when you see, like, when you watch Little Yachty and he can't freestyle, it's not within his thing to freestyle
or know who Rakim is.
Yeah, exactly.
Why would he?
Well,
he doesn't know that. He doesn't know any... Number one, freestyling's garbage. Let's admit this.
Yes,
now.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Yeah,
It's. I loved it back then. It was. Yeah. That's what I made $1 million because of. It is a bad art form now. It was taken almost by like theatrical nerds. It's become. It's not even cool anymore.
Well, I was going to talk to you about this. What the battle scene has become now?
Yeah.
Because there's no music. There's no musicality to it.
There is none. And I came up in battling. Yeah. That was all I really liked doing, and I battled hardcore for years and years and years with a beat. And freestyle.
Yeah.
I had lines that I would go to every once in a while, but 90% of it was freestyle. Hip hop battles now, from King of the Dot to Don't Flop to Smack, those are no beats.
Yeah.
And they are all written. You know, barely freestyle. A couple freestyles here or there, but lines, but not all written. And you would think, I'd think of it as like a purist, like I think it's better. Why would I want to hear dudes rhyming you know, the same, my style is, you know, they always say my style is, or things that, you know, the thing they repeat all the time. Like I can't even watch myself freestyle now.
Really?
From videos back in the day.
Yeah.
Like it's so much better to hear dudes rhyme like for reals and write it down. Like good for them. It's better. Yeah. But I'm also progressive now. Like I don't even hate on dudes anymore. Like,
right.
What record did I download that I, oh, Russ. Russ is so easy to make fun of now, right? Like he's such a punching bag.
Yeah.
I think the Russ record's great. Like I've become nerdy about it. Like I'm almost like, you can't find something good in these things. Like there's always something decent. Like I'll erase a whole album if I don't like it, but like I'll listen to everything and I find something good in almost everything.
Well, it's weird, isn't it? Cause like sort of when we were growing up listening to hip hop, the fact that it changed so much and it was so fast moving was why we loved it.
And now we hate it.
And now we hate
it
because of that.
Thing.
Yeah.
It's so
weird.
Insane. And to me, if hip hop was still reflecting what 40-year-olds liked, it wouldn't be what we loved.
Yeah.
And now you want these guys to like respect these artists. It's like, to me, why would little Zanny know who Thurston Howell III is?
Barely
anyone knew who Thurston Howell III was when he was around. Like, the other thing is like Eminem, right? So the two largest influences in hip hop right now, in my opinion, are 808s and Heartbreaks, period. That's the most influential thing in hip hop to me.
You think so?
I don't care for it. I thought it was his worst record.
Yeah.
But like kids seem to love it.
Right.
It changed hip hop. No one even liked it really. It was like kind of a throwout record.
Well, I remember being amazed by how ballsy it was for him to put a record out like that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I didn't even really like it. I mean, now I listen to what, 3 songs?
Yeah.
Tops? But kids seem to love it. It like that age group that now is coming up are all influenced heavily by it, right?
Yeah.
Like you could almost etch Future to it, right?
Yeah.
And so that record, and then early Eminem is having a nice resurgence right now, right? So like a lot of people are sort of referencing early M and admitting that late M is not something that's influencing anyone, right?
Yeah.
So like we had a kid on our podcast named Lou the Human, who's like an upcoming Brooklyn kid. He's awesome. He's starting to get a lot of buzz. And he sounds like early M, right? And he's highly influenced by early M. And I go, and he's here on the podcast, and I go, and you know, you sound a lot like Cage. And he goes, who's Cage?
Right.
Oh, well, all right. And he sounds just like Cage.
Yeah.
And so it's not like he's ripping off Cage. It's just you have to wonder where influences start and how the game of telephone almost happens.
Yeah.
Which is like Chino XL is... Eminem never admitted it, but Chino XL is Eminem's highest influence. You know, that's where he got all his influence.
It's gotta be, yeah.
It has to be. He says Redman, but that's a lie.
Yeah.
The truth is he got everything from Chino XL. The same way I got everything from Chino XL.
It's your complex that rips and wrecks your confidence, creates paranoia inside of your mind when you rhyme. But I got black soul. Blows I create unforgettable like Nat King Cole. Bullet holes through the shields of your Land Cruiser. My click is stolen like they eyes gazed upon Medusa.
Making this picture clearer.
It gets witter than incest. Knowledge my name, I'm on a different plane like Harvey.
So Eminem never said Chino XL, said Redman, But in real life, there was another guy named Cage who sounded just like him. But the, same. But the only thing they're going to pull out when you're 19 years old is Eminem.
Yeah.
And that's the influence they got that's watered down from so-and-so, that's watered down from so. So eventually all this shit's going to have some sort of reflection. But these kids don't know who they are. They don't know who they are. He doesn't know who Chino XL is.
Yeah,
he doesn't know who Flatliners are.
I know. I get it. And I get it. Why should he? But,
I met Tyga when he was 18.
Right.
I met Tyga, 18 years old. This is he just released that like pineapple juice song or whatever bullshit he put out. And we're at a party and he's and a friend, a mutual friend, says he used to rap. He was on Interscope. And Tyga's super nice, kind kid at the time. Probably now a piece of shit. But at the time, it's totally nice. And he goes, yeah, so you were in during these days. I go, yeah. And he goes, people, and he even at the time, this it wasn't really reflected in pop culture, but he was like, people always think I should know more about old school stuff. And I was like, oh, you definitely should not know. don't waste your time. And he goes, well, what are the two records that I should be into? And I go, well, two that you'll love are Camp Lo, because I had heard his Juice song or whatever that was. And I was like, you're going to love Camp Lo. And then I said, and then Gravediggers is my favorite record of all time. I was like, so, you know, you make up your mind if you want to get him or whatever. And I saw him a second time. Saw him like 3 weeks later, and he came up to me and he was like, both of those albums are incredible. He's like, Camp Lo changed my life. I was like, well, yeah, now I listen to his music. I'm like, didn't change it enough. but I mean, he cared enough to listen.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's sort of the...
That is interesting.
That's the way you do it, is not saying that you have to know these guys. You don't have to know anything.
By the way, I've got to say, Gravediggers, you've got to be the first person to mention that album on this podcast.
Oh, greatest album ever.
It's incredible, right?
60 Deep's the best record ever made.
Be a witness as I exercise my exorcism. The evil that lurks within, the sin, the terrorism. Possessed by evil spirits, voices from the dead. I come forth with gravediggers in a head full of dread. I've been examined ever since I was semen. They took a sonogram and seen the image of a demon. At birth, nurses surrounded me with needles and drugged me all up with the diseases of evil.
What did you think of the pick, the sickle, and the shovel?
It's fine. It's fine. I mean, obviously, their focus was... here's the reason. Gravediggers' album is so good because it's a bunch of guys who failed, right? Yeah. People don't know the metaphor of Gravediggers because you just want to look at it as like a horrorcore record. The truth is that it's guys who failed, who couldn't get the industry to look at them, so they basically created dead characters to come back from the dead. I mean, it's just it's a very direct metaphor, but no one saw it at the time. And the album is actually a concept album about guys restarting their career. You know, that's what it was.
Yeah.
And so if you love... 36 Chambers is obviously the more commercial answer to what you're... And they're very similar.
Yeah.
So RZA and Prince Paul, the two greatest producers in my mind of all time, produced a record together.
Yeah.
And they don't do that on Sickle. So if you're looking for the one where it's the two guys together, you only have 6 Feet Deep.
How big was that album here?
It was pretty big. It went platinum.
Right.
But like as far as like how much it's withheld, you know, the test of time, I mean, it doesn't come up a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, if you were a Wu-Tang guy, you had to have bought the record. So it was a platinum record. I have a tattoo. I have the Sickle tattoo.
Do you really?
I do, yeah. So I'm like a super fan.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So, but it really did change my life. It was the first time I heard a rap record and thought, I don't have to be direct.
Right.
It was like these guys are characters.
Yeah.
Maybe I can be myself. Like, I know that sounds weird. These guys are characters. Maybe I can be myself. But it was like, the world is open.
Yeah.
And they were the first people for me to hear it. And in the same way that, like, I knew Ozzy Osbourne wasn't really, like, a Satan worshiper.
Yeah.
It was similar to this. It was the first time I heard a rap group and was like, oh, fuck yeah. This is...
It happens... It's amazing that... You know, it happens so rarely in hip-hop, I guess, doesn't it? That sort of thing.
Almost never.
Yeah.
And Paul's usually involved in them when they do happen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Prime, 6 Feet Deep is the record. I mean, at this point, when someone posts about Gravediggers or release, you know, like some sort of merch, I'm always the first person tagged on it. I mean, I praise it like it's... I mean, it really is. It's truly incredible.
Yeah. Well, listen, look, we're almost out of time, but I want to... you've been amazing.
Thanks, man.
But I want to ask you about Drop the Mic.
Yeah.
So how did it come about? So Drop the Mic basically is... It came from an item on The Late Late Show.
And
you're behind that item in the first instance, right?
Yeah, I had done this rap. I've been doing a lot of comedy writing since those days and a lot of award shows. And one of the award shows was the MTV Movie Awards. And they wanted a song moment. And I had this idea where Rock and Kevin Hart do a rap. It went viral. And my agent was like, you could pretty much go in anywhere if you have a rap idea today. Because it was like everywhere. And I was like, yeah, I have this thing about rap battling. I want to teach celebrities how to do it. And she was like, where do you want to take it? And I said, well, the lip sync battle people. And then she goes, what about Corden? And I go, oh yeah, I guess that'd be good.
Yeah.
And so I went and met with Ben Winston and James and pitched this idea, showed them King of the Dot and Don't Flop and Smack, and showed them all these things about what I can do. And they were accepting. They loved it. They thought the idea was great. And James obviously can do it. I told James the reason I even knew he could do it is because he did that Carpool Karaoke with Iggy Azalea.
Yeah.
And I immediately knew he had a better flow than her, which isn't, I mean, whatever. Still, it's good. It's still, yeah, he rap better than her. And I said, let's do it. Got Anne Hathaway to do it. And from there, it's been, you know, sort of smooth sailing on the show. David Schwimmer, Usain Bolt, Kevin Hart, Dave Franco, Cara Delevingne. We've done Method Man now. We've done a bunch of people there on that show. And then TBS saw that and offered it to be its own show, because that's kind of how I always saw it, as its own show.
Yeah.
So TBS called Ben and CBS and said, why don't we make this into its own show? And now we are in the middle of season one.
So
Method Man is our host, yeah.
Yeah.
My actual hero. That's my
it's
hero.
Incredible, right?
That's my actual hero, yeah. From rapping. His logo was my license plate when I was 16.
Yeah. The thing about a show like Drop the Mic is, but as a hip hop fan, when you first hear about it, you think this is going to be the worst thing that's ever happened, right? That I've watched it thinking I was going to be like, okay, they've put hip hop in this sort of weird, it's not a weird setting at all, it's what hip hop is, but it's just sort of, you think a mainstream TV show that has hip hop in it, that's normally not done very well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was my whole thing. Like, when I went into James and Ben, I said, no one can ever say my name is. My name is something I'm here to say. No one can ever do that. No one can ever wear gold teeth.
Yeah.
No one can ever wear chains. No one can ever wear backwards hats unless that's what they normally wear.
Yeah.
I said anyone who's playing a rapper is off the show. You know, this is normal people going in and learning how to rap in their normal voice. And we're going to have the best lyricists and the best comedians writing their stuff. And let's respect the art form.
Well, and I think that's something that hasn't been done before, I think.
No.
In terms of a hip-hop thing for mainstream television that is done with affection. Do you know what I mean? Rather than sort of pointing and making fun.
And it's crazy because, like, most of the hatred that we get online are from people who've either seen just a small clip or never watched the show.
Yeah.
If you actually watch the show, 80% of our battles are extremely good, respectful battles. They're just good battles.
Yeah.
We have, in the next few weeks, we have Kenny G versus Richard Marx,
nice,
which is like a fucking nightmare. Like, you hear that and you're like, holy. And Carter Deems, who is an incredible rap battler that we have on our show as a writer, he turned to me during it and he said, this is the most fun I've ever had watching a battle.
He says,
and I'm not offended. Like, these dudes love this and they're good at it. And that's what we try to do in most of the cases. We fail sometimes, but a very large majority of our battles are ones that can stand on their own.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is crazy. I'm shocked myself.
Yeah. Okay, listen, we're out of time. At Jensen, what an amazing story.
Thanks, man.
Thank you so much for talking to me. And definitely check out both Drop the Mic and Jensen's book, Kanye West Owes Me $300, as soon as you can. Is there anything else you want to
give a plug? Tim Westwood, man. Go listen to his show. Listen to his weird-ass fucking strange character.
Bang those cell block doors.
Oh, block, block. You freestyle? You go freestyle for us? I'm like, what the fuck is he? What? Yes, you've been doing this 20 years. They're definitely going to freestyle for you, you weirdo. Yo, we could put on a beat. Did you could go? Yeah, they come here to do that, Tim. That's what they're there to do that. I don't know. What if they say no, Tim? What if they say no?
Thank you, Jensen.
Thank you.